Good morning, everyone. This morning, to honor the Jewish New Year, the shofar will call us to worship. First, I would like to read a little bit of what Rabbi Aidan Steinsaltz wrote about the shofar. The Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, is the beginning of the first day of the new year, and its central feature is the blowing of the ram's horn. The horn is not, nor has it ever been, a musical instrument. It emits only a harsh blast, a wailing, groaning, threatening, annoying, and frightening cry. The blowing of the ram's horn at the start of the new year is a hint to sleepers to awake from their slumber. It is a call to examine their souls and improve their ways. The ram's horn, therefore, is not intended to beguile the ear, but to arouse, shock, provoke those who sleep. Its wailing is a call to awaken from the lethargy of routine.
Good morning, everybody. Very nice to be here. The use of the shofar goes back about 6,000 years. In ancient times was used for many purposes, basically to communicate over long distances. And rams molt their horns. I don't know if it's annually or biannually, but you think of being the first person that saw this thing lying on the ground and decided, I think I'll haul this out and blow into it. So in the Rosh Hashanah service, the shofar is sounded 101 times. The 101st one is at the very end, and it's called Tekiah Gedolah, and Gedol means big, so it's a really long note. So we're going to do that at the end of the service. So there are three Hebrew words that are said before each one. There's three different sounds, and that's what we'll do. I have four of them here. This is the traditional shofar, but no one looks. This is really a nice-looking one. It's very old. It doesn't sound that good anymore. This is one I got in Jerusalem that's from an ibex, so it looks really different. And this I got in Safat, which is a city in north central Israel. It's in the mountains, so it's actually above the cloud line, so it's a pretty incredible place. And I just tried this and I really liked it, so I came home with the shofar. And this is one I found in my house several years ago. So I put it in this case I have for stuff I don't know what to do with. It looks nice. And this is probably 200 or 250 years old, but I can't get a sound out of it. Anyway.
Shavarim.
Three notes.
Teruah. Tekiah. And so year follows year in endless succession. What was will be again. The individual may enjoy this endless repetition throughout one's life without ever reaching any kind of reckoning. Every year will be for that person just one more old year, the same old dream without end, the same vicious cycle from which there is no escape. That is why the shofar is sounded, its simple, ear-assaulting cry. It's wordless wailing, since no words are understood by all. Thus, there is a possibility that the coming year will be more than a mere repetition of its predecessor, that within the cycle of the seasons, there is room for hope that the coming year may be truly new. Our reading this morning is by Unitarian Universalist Minister Victoria Safford. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope. Not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower. Not the stalwart, boring gates of common sense. Nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges. People cannot hear us there. They cannot pass through. Not the cheerful, flimsy gate of everything's going to be all right. But a different, sometimes lonely place the place of truth-telling, about your own soul first and its condition, the place of resistance and defiance, the piece of ground from which you see the world, both as it is and as it could be, as it will be. The place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but the joy of struggle. And we stand there beckoning and calling, telling people what we are seeing, asking people what they see. So today at sundown, Rosh Hashanah begins. The biblical name for Rosh Hashanah is Yom Teruah. And the word teruah means, it comes from the root, which means raise a noise. We have raised a noise by blowing the shofar today. This noise is meant, as we said before, to pierce our hearts, startle us out of tired routines, and awaken the possibility of real change. We spent some time in our family service today thinking about why we especially need to wake up to a new and different new year, now more than ever. We spoke about the climate crisis that is urgently calling us to change our ways and to demand change from our institutions. But this is not the only crisis that demands change. There is a humanitarian crisis at the border. We are beset with entrenched and worsening xenophobia and white supremacist nationalism. Poverty, housing crises, violence, all these and so much more afflict our nation. Incarceration rates have risen exponentially in recent decades with staggering disproportionality for Black and brown people. And on, the depth of the hurt can numb us. The cacophony of howls can drown the shofar's wake-up call. As a teen, I was skeptical about humanity. I kept a mental list of massive social problems and had no clear sense that anybody was doing anything about it. One Sunday, my church youth group made sandwiches and we went to serve them to homeless folks at the soup kitchen. Along with the sandwiches, I brought with me what I now understand to be an implicitly paternalistic idea about community service, that we, the privileged, are responsible for charitable giving and implementing reforms to solve homelessness. And I failed to recognize the humanity of the people I gave sandwiches to. Instead of a fellow human being, I saw a problem to be solved. It was like handing a sandwich across a fence electrified by judgment. And this filled me with fear and guilt and despair. Instead of the hope that experiences of shared humanity and connection can offer. Years later, when I first started hanging out with my partner Adam, he was hanging around at an environmental justice organization in Roxbury called Alternatives for Community and Environment, or ACE for short. Let me tell you, a crush is a great way to get involved in activism. So I followed Adam to ACE and met grassroots organizers there, people surviving and thriving through the crises of our city, violence, poverty, gentrification and displacement, racism, pollution. These organizers were people who were building power to make changes and fight for clean and healthy places to live, work, and play. So early on in my time as an ACE groupie, I met an organizer there named Brenda. And Brenda was staying at a scatter site shelter. So this meant that she and her children had their own apartment through the state homeless assistance program. Several of us ACE folks went to her place one evening, and we got to talking, and we stayed later than the tea could get us home. I had a moment saying, well, me and Adam, we could just take a cab back to JP where we live. And she looked at me like I had lost my mind. From where her apartment was, she informed me, a cab would cost somewhere between $40 and $50. Not worth it. Just stay the night. I was in my early 20s, and so normally a spontaneous sleepover would not have been a big deal. But my confusion was telling. Her world was so different from mine, and more to the point, was implicitly not for me. Her life was perhaps dangerous, or untrustworthy, or in need of beneficence. I was out of my comfort zone. I sat with the discomfort for a moment and thought, what am I really uncomfortable about? We're friends. This is what friends do. So I spent the night, and of course it was completely fine, better than that. She gave me a precious gift. Receiving her hospitality and friendship, I could recognize that Brenda was not a problem to be solved, but a fellow human being who makes a delicious plate of scrambled eggs. Since I wasn't living on the streets when I was a teen, when I was handing out sandwiches at the soup kitchen, I thought I didn't have any skin in the game. I saw other people hurting and felt bad for them. I felt upset that they didn't have a home. But I was operating under the false pretense that I was supposed to somehow save them. This got me stuck in despair. And so, in my young adulthood, when I was welcomed to the organizing table to work on systemic solutions, when I met and formed relationships with movement leaders who had experienced homelessness and who were in the struggle to save their own lives, that was when I could realize that I had neglected our common humanity. I had neglected the possibility of power and the interconnectedness of all our lives. It was like the shofar had pierced my heart, waking me up to the possibility of change, finding hope and joy in the struggle for a better world. But hope in the struggle can strain under the weight of these times. We are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction on this earth. The first time that a single species, ours, has been responsible for such loss. And it is happening at a rate of thousands rather than millions of years. When I was preparing for this sermon, I spent some time listening to podcasts about the extent of the climate crisis. I looked at the time one afternoon, and I realized I had about 3 minutes before a planning meeting for the open house that we were having this afternoon. I heard the doorbell ring, went down to the front door, and found a member of the planning team was there, so I opened the door for her. She saw my face. She said, "What's wrong?" I said, "Oh, nothing." She said, "Are you sure?" I said, "No, I'm good." Well, that was a lie. I was numb and despairing after the podcast I had just listened to. I could have shared that with her, but I didn't. It was as if I had been operating as if I was supposed to be a beacon of hope and faith to you all at all times. And that is actually the opposite of what I am called to be with you. Just because I'm your minister, it doesn't mean that I can't also be grieving mass extinction and these life-threatening changes to our atmosphere, our water, our relationships to land. It doesn't mean I have to be fully assured of my faith and hope at all times. I'm called to be human with you, to share my fears as well as my faith. I have heard it said that you should not preach from your wounds, but rather your scars. Don't preach from the places that are actively hurting. But if I were to follow that advice, you would never hear me talk about climate change. You would never hear me talk about prisons or oppression, racism, the border, war, all the ways that we hurt one another. We don't come to church to pretend that everything's okay. We don't come to pretend that we're not scared. We can practice vulnerability with one another here. We can witness to our shared capacity to stay in the struggle. We can lean on one another. We can stay in the struggle together with our vulnerability, with our fears. At a UU clergy workshop this summer, I brought my despair, all of us did, and we shared it with one another. We told stories of those who continue to fight despite the weight of these times. And we sang through it all. We sang many songs. There's one that I want to share with you here today. One that I think many of you know, but I had never heard it before. It's "I Am Willing" by Holly Near. Are there people here who know that song? Yeah. Singing this song with my fellow UUs, people whom I knew were struggling to hope just as much as I was, it buoyed me once again. I want to try to sing it. If you know it, will you sing with me? I am open and I am willing, for to be hopeless would seem so strange. It dishonors those who go before us. So lift me up to the light of change. Should we try it again? I am open and I am willing, for to be hopeless would seem so strange. It dishonors those who go before us. So lift me up to the light of change. It catches in my throat every time, that line. To be hopeless dishonors those who go before us. As Unitarian Universalists, one of the sources of our faith tradition is the words and deeds of prophetic people which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transformative power of love. These prophetic people, these are the ones who go before us. We inherit the struggle from them. We inherit dogged hope. It's not the same as fearless hope. For me, these prophetic people also include Brenda and the other grassroots organizers I have learned from over the years. They include Sebastian and the young people I met at the Youth Climate Strike right here in Sharon last Friday. The list goes on and on. Who are your prophetic people? Think of them. Before we decided to have children, I was talking with Adam and his extended family about my doubts about having a child over dinner. The future seems too imperiled, too unsure, I said. Adam's sister-in-law's mother replied, "We thought the same thing when we were having kids because of the recession in the 70s, and our parents thought the same thing because of the Cold War." She had a point. There has never been a perfect time in human history to have a baby. It reminded me of what I once heard someone named Adrienne Marie Brown say. She's an author and, in her words, a facilitator for Black liberation. This is what she said from her perspective as a Black person. "Black people in America today are the result of our enslaved ancestors' liberatory imaginations, their capacity to imagine and work for a free future for their children." People bring children into this world in war zones, in prisons, in refugee camps, and fight like hell for these babies. Now that I have had June, I realize what she's done for me. She's given me even more skin in the game. And she's revealed to me that I'm in it for all these children, not just my own progeny. And we do all this regardless of any expected outcome. We resist racism. We fight homelessness. We call for an end to deadly border policies. We call for the dignity of migrants. We follow the lead of those most impacted, for their struggle at the front lines of harm is our education and our true shofar's call. We do all this precisely because we have an inkling of the extent of these catastrophes and the ways we have wronged each other. It is as our reading this morning tells us, Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, a place that is sometimes lonely, a place of truth-telling about your own soul first of all and its condition, the place of resistance and defiance, the piece of ground from which you see the world, both as it is and as it could be. James Baldwin once said, "I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive." To be a pessimist means you have agreed that human life is an academic matter, so I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. We, too, agree. Human life is not an academic matter. Let us hear the shofar's call and join our voices with its harsh sound. Let us find hope in the struggle for life itself. May it be so. Let's pause and join hearts in meditation and prayer. Let us breathe into the broken places in our hearts. Let us recognize our losses. Let us grieve them. And when we come to the place of truth-telling, the ground from which we know the world, let us hear the shofar's call. May we be open. May we be willing. May we honor those who go before us. May we be lifted up to the light of change. Amen and blessed be. Our closing words come to us today from Howard Zinn. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is in itself a marvelous victory. Go in peace. We'll end our service with another shofar call. Tekiah Gedolah.